You could just tell that a whooping was coming. In 1904, the Democratic Party met in St. Louis and nominated an obscure but honest judge of the New York Appeals Court, Alton J. Parker, for President of the United States, to run against one of history's most dynamic and charismatic presidents, Theodore Roosevelt. For vice president, they nominated Henry Gassaway Davis, a wealthy West Virginia railroad tycoon. He was 81 years old. He remains the oldest person ever to be nominated by a major party for the vice presidency. He was chosen for a couple of reasons, but one stands out. Davis was rich, and they hoped that he'd fund the campaign. But he did not. As it turns out, he made no more than a nominal contribution. But in one area, Davis did not disappoint. Though he was born when James Monroe was president, Republicans mentioned that quite a bit as they nominated their younger VP candidate, Senator Charles Fairbanks of Indiana, the state of amber waves of grain. Davis made it to what would have been the end of his one term in office in 1909. Then he lived to see what would have been his second term of office that he won in 1913. So joyous were West Virginians that he survived that they almost nominated him for Senate when he was 87, just to show everyone. He passed at the age of 91, just 2 years before Senator Fairbanks. A footnote with a record that will not be broken now in this election, and probably will not be broken anytime soon. I suppose wealth is as good as any reason for a vice presidential nomination. There were a few other reasons, though, for Davis's nomination. Maybe they figured they might have a shot at his state of West Virginia. They didn't, despite the octogenarian's noble stumping. And Davis, of all the conservatives, and 1904 was a year that the conservatives in the Democratic Party took control, and the party went back to their gold bug side. The Cleveland Democrats, the Bourbon Democrats, tried maybe to court the businesses that Theodore Roosevelt might have annoyed with his progressive stances and win the election. But of all of those in the conservative faction of the Democratic Party, Davis agreed with William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the progressive opposing the conservatives at this convention. He had agreed with him on the tariff issue, and on the platform committee where Davis served, he worked to get Bryan on board on the monetary issue with a proposal to say nothing on the gold and silver question. Now, Bryan, of course, was a silverite. He wanted more silver money printed. He wanted an inflationary policy. Yet in 1904, he had just lost two elections in 1896 and 1900. He had a little less power within the Democratic Party organization after losing twice than he did before. He could go for a platform that said nothing and sit this one out and run for a third term in 1908, which is exactly what he did. And okay, he said when asked. When Davis's name was mentioned, well, he wouldn't object to it. After all, he agreed with me on the tariff. Good enough. The party wasn't exactly unified, but the VP nomination helped ensure that there was no bolting from St. Louis. In 1928, the Democratic National Committee now found itself in Houston, Texas. It's a city that just rolls off the tongue now as a major city of the United States, but it's not a city that they would have considered in 1904 or even 1920. But in this year, Houston was the boom city of the South. The building of a ship channel allowed big ships to come in from the Gulf, and the town grew fast. Several 10-story buildings cropped up, a zoo, a symphony, a Sears department store, and a giant arena. From 90,000 persons in 1910, the city now had 250,000 people. Paltry compared to Chicago's 3.3 million, but on the rise nonetheless. It was still an odd choice. Now it's rattled off as one of America's big cities, but then it was about 27th in terms of metropolitan areas in America. Time magazine still found it necessary in 1928 to offer its readers a pronunciation guide to say that it was pronounced Houston, as opposed to the street in New York City, Houston. The choice of Houston might also have been at odds with the nominee. delegates came to the city knowing that they would nominate on the first ballot with little opposition the governor of New York, a Catholic, and a wet, a supporter of the repeal of prohibition and the resumption of the sale of alcohol in the United States. Texas was dry, supporting the prohibition, the 18th Amendment, and the enforcement of it. And by and large, its delegation wanted nothing to do with Smith. 500 women would demonstrate in the city, praying that someone else would become the Democratic nominee. The prayers were not answered. But why Houston? Well, one man, Jesse Holman Jones, known as Mr. Houston, he had made a fortune off dredging. He offered to pay for the entire convention. He'd write a check for $200,000. Whatever wasn't used by the convention, expenses in Houston, he'd use for the campaign. But that wasn't all. We know it's June. We know it's Houston, and many of your delegates are coming from the north, so we'll keep you comfortable with giant fans, the latest technology, millions of cubic feet of air through the hall, the latest water coolers of 1928, and we strongly suggest linen suits for the delegate. But that's not all. As the new finance chair for the Democratic National Committee, Jesse H. Jones would help retire the debt from the failed 1924 campaign. But wait. Something else. The Texas delegation wouldn't back Smith, but they would nominate him, Jesse H. Jones, for president, if he said so. And then, as a favorite son, he'd have the Texas delegation and then throw his delegate to Smith. All the Democratic Party had to do in return was hold the convention with its 25,000 delegates, alternates, wives, and visitors in Houston. To bring the newspapers, the newsreel, the radio to this boom city and shine the spotlight of America on it for one shining moment. How's that sound? The party took the deal, and even the New York Tammany Hall delegates, known for their wild parties at conventions, kept this one low-key. No marching band came to Houston. New York Mayor Jimmy Walker went on the wagon, for a week at least. The Tammany Hall boss told his people to do calisthenics and take cold showers. And the Brown Derby, Governor Al Smith, was nominated. To satisfy disgruntled Southerners now that they officially had a wet candidate, they worked out a platform assisted by a Methodist bishop and anti-saloon leaguers, in which Smith, though a wet, committed to enforce the 18th Amendment as it was part of the Constitution, and he had to enforce the Constitution, while he can still attack Coolidge for permitting corruption in the national offices, and hinted that he'd pass more of the enforcement duties to states instead of corrupt federal agents. But he'd enforce the 18th Amendment. And just to show how everyone could get along, they nominated a dry Joe Robinson, senator from Arkansas, on the ticket as the vice presidential nominee. One newspaper joked, "The donkey left Houston with a wet head and a dry tail." It is old hat for a party to choose a running mate to be sure its two wings or three wings are all intact. You could pluck out a few representative examples across time. 1836, when Martin Van Buren cut a deal with Richard Mentor Johnson, the Indian War cavalryman who claimed to have shot Tecumseh. "Don't run," Martin Van Buren said. "Don't run against me at the convention, and you can be old Kinderhook's running mate." Johnson took the deal, though he spent most of his vice presidency in his native home as Kentucky. In 1864, Democrats met during the Civil War and needed to be careful lest they appear unpatriotic for opposing Lincoln during the war. General George B. McClellan worked. As a former commander of Union forces, no civilian could question his patriotism. His name was well known. But McClellan was publicly for continuing the war. So, to please those of the minority view, which was a large part of the Democratic Party at the time, that the North should make immediate peace with the South, they nominated Ohio Congressman George Pendleton, who, though he didn't have that exact position publicly, was very well liked in those circles among the people that would have been called Copperheads at that time. 1884 makes a great illustration of fusion tickets on both sides. James Blaine, from the half-breed Republican faction, and John Logan, one of those good old stalwart factions on the Republican side, up against Grover Cleveland, the reformed Democrat that many Republicans love. mixed with Thomas Hendricks, the good old walk-the-plank party man from Indiana. Amber waves of grain. The 20th Century offered some of these tickets as well. McNary, the establishment guy, runs to keep an eye on that Wendell Willkie and keep party faithful aligned with the upstart. Gerald Ford picks Bob Dole to appease conservatives, upset that Reagan didn't win the primary. Johnson picks Hubert Humphrey, hoping he'll please all the liberal people who thought that Johnson could be a little more like Kennedy. A VP nominee pick is the party's chance, and in recent history, the presidential nominee's chance, to show that they can reach out the hand of the other faction of their political party and show it to the world. Thus, with Mitt Romney's selection of Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan to be his choice for vice president, the most apparent effect is instant party unity. Right? Romney ostensibly comes from that moderate wing of the Republican Party. Early support from George H.W. Bush and his supporters, backing of Northern governors, and he was able to beat his opponents. Yet there was perhaps some latent resentment among the rank and file. You know, he's not a real Republican, that health care plan in Massachusetts, he's not one of our guys, just a lesser of two evils, all of that kind of thinking. In this one swing, Romney scores a home run inside the Republican ballpark. I talked previously about how in history, there are four real reasons for VP picks. Geography, party unity, buzz, and making up for nominee's deficiencies. Elements of many in all the picks, but usually one stands out. This is a party unity pick. That doesn't mean there's other reasons, but this is a party unity pick. I'm sure you're going to see about Wisconsin and how it'll be more in play now. And yes, a Washington choice brings a person who's been a governor and head of an Olympic committee, Romney, you know, help in the capital city if he gets there. There's also a little buzz with any pick, and this one has had its share of buzz, particularly because it was a bit of a surprise, right? We were probably expecting to hear about Mark Rubio or Bob Portman, somebody from one of the swing states. And I think that if you're the challenger, and I said this previously, you've got to have a message. You've got to articulate a vision. You can't just be the critic, although that's certainly going to be part of a challenger's role. And since you're the challenger, and a lot's going to depend on what happens with the incumbent and public perception of the incumbent, it doesn't always work whether they have a vision or not. But it seems like the best plan, especially because a few complacent people might have lost the presidency because they didn't have one. So Romney wins a bit on this front. You know, he was a little bit on the defensive in the past couple of months. There wasn't a lot to get excited about. Reactive campaign. They made this announcement and definitely gained some momentum. Took the party firmly under his control, and along with Ryan now as the symbolic stamp of approval within the party and an easy conduit to the most important part of the party right now. The House of Representatives is going to be the most important part that Romney needs to work with during the campaign, and if he wins. In building that bridge, the Romney campaign has built a stronger foundation than it had. Does seem better than if Romney had chosen an obscure person. One quick historical note with the Ryan choice. It is rare that a sitting member of the House of Representatives is chosen to serve. Of course, the last was Geraldine Ferraro in 1984. Walter Mondale had made the decision to choose a woman on the ticket. Once he did that, he had to go to the House of Representatives. And Gerald Ferraro had served several terms representing Queens, New York. Of course, you had former House members who had another job in between the service in the House and the vice presidency. I mean, there's many of those. Millard Fillmore was member of the House, then he was New York comptroller, and then he was nominated for vice president. Adlai Stevenson, not the presidential candidate, but the grandfather of him who was vice president, did a stint as assistant postmaster between his time in the House and the VP nomination. Jack Kemp was HUD secretary between his time in the House and when Bob Dole picked him to be his vice presidential nominee. Most picks in history are senators, and governors also rate pretty high. But there are many others. I mean, we mentioned Henry Gassaway Davis. He was just a member of the Democratic National Committee. Senators have a bigger name, a better chance of pulling a state, the entire state, since they've voted for them at least once, you know, in a statewide election. There's 435 members of the House, and they can only truly guarantee their own district. Thus, in a House member pick, geography was probably not on Romney's mind. He also didn't pick somebody from the states that have been on the map as clear swing states that are need to win: Florida, Virginia, Ohio. All of this points to the importance of the House right now. It is the only part of the federal system controlled by the Republican Party currently. It's rare that a party can take the House while losing the presidency. In other words, it's rare that Obama would lose the presidential election, but Democrats would retain the House. So Romney, if he becomes president, is almost guaranteed that he's going to have a friend in that body in the federal government that he'll have to work with to be effective. This, I think, gives the pick some advantages. Paul Ryan, as the chair of the Budget Committee, put out a plan calling for spending cuts that bears his name. The plan was supported by almost all House Republicans and most of the senators. So the Romney campaign from the pick instantly gets control of the campaign, because while Romney may not be somebody who could walk into the House of Representatives and immediately demand anything right now, Ryan certainly has shown that he is. The Romney campaign also gets a plan, a vision that the party is united behind. What it does miss with this pick, the Romney campaign, is an opportunity for enormous buzz, or to symbolically, as a party, reach out to Latino voters that might have kept people talking through the election and confounded some of the state-by-state models that people are building. But it's not surprising that Romney did not reach out to his primary rivals, Gingrich or Santorum, in his selection, as others have. You know, Reagan chose George H.W. Bush, John Kerry chose John Edwards. Actually, Gingrich or Santorum or any of those others would not have ensured Romney the kind of unity that Ryan gets him instantly. Both would have forced him into contradictory positions, those annoying videos of his veep-to-be attacking Romney on issues. It's not a race to the middle here. Each party so far has seen what this Bush campaign strategist Karl Rove saw in 2004. It's time to go after the faithful. So you've seen the president move on gay marriage, and you've seen the president move on immigration. Romney's now selecting Ryan, which implies an endorsement of the Ryan plan and puts him firmly for spending cuts. So I see this as a very partisan choice. It's an appeal to the base, and it's going to be a turnout election. So he's hoping that in Florida, Virginia, and Ohio, instead of picking somebody from those states — yeah, that's one way to do it, but I couldn't pick somebody from all three of them — here's somebody that can get turnout up in the party, and perhaps some of those close states will win the turnout battle instead of the Democrats. If they're successful in putting out the message that I've selected deficit cutter, he's a person who is willing to do anything to reduce this big problem that America has, the deficit. And if that's the way they're able to present it, to continue to present this as a guy that's just on the ticket to solve a problem, not to attack people, then I could see that as more of an appeal to, say, the swing voters. Right now, it does seem like a very partisan election on both sides. 1981, during a budget meeting with his budget director, David Stockman, Ronald Reagan, Michael Deaver, James Baker, in the Oval Office. Stockman's doing all kind of crazy calculations in his calculator, is, you know, bringing in reams of computer printouts, and says, look, I got good news. We're 93% of where we need to get to, and we do not have to cut Medicare or other programs for the needy. Reagan just replied, that's wonderful news. Reagan had already committed during the campaign and had held to it during these budget talks that he would not touch Social Security. He said, I'm sorry, boys, I promised during the campaign I would not do that. Now they're getting the news they don't have to announce a cut in Medicare either, which the Democrats are going to kill them over. Michael Deaver asked, how quickly can we get this out to a press? Jim Baker, everyone's agreed, send out a press release. David Stockman, though, had not finished. And he tried to finish and say, I meant so far, I'm 93% of the way of getting to where you want in terms of the budget. Maybe get to a balanced budget here, and I so far don't have to cut those programs. So far. Nonetheless, a press release was sent out. The Reagan administration will not cut Medicare or seven programs to help the needy. We'll keep in $210 billion for these programs. it is interesting to go back in time there where you would not dare attack Social Security and Medicare, and now go forward in the time machine and you have a party that is proposing a drastic change in Medicare, which may not will move Medicare away from the system of simply covering costs as they occur and go more to a allotment-based system. Now, so with the positive, which is now the Romney Ryan has a plan, now they're out there, now there's a vision, now you have a choice. The other side of that is that your army's out in the field, and once your army's out in the field, it can be attacked. So there are certainly Democrats getting giddy about their prospects in Florida with this Medicare issue. But despite the change from the Reagan administration to now, and that a Republican Party would even dare to go after Medicare, I mean, obviously that Republicans in the 90s proposed cuts into Medicare, so this is not new territory. And Clinton matched with some cuts in Medicare, but a limited amount. This is not new territory. Program's different. The program's larger. We have a larger deficit, and we'll have a larger population in the future to provide these services too. So there's more arguments for doing it than there was in 1981. But it is interesting to note the political change. If you listen to Ryan talk, one of the things that he says is that he believes that putting these issues out on the table, and there was a lot of opposition, you know, initially to the Ryan plan among the Republicans in Congress. The Ryan plan has not been tested in an election. It was not something that Republicans stood out on the 2010 election and said, this is our plan, vote for us. The vote on it occurred after the election and has not yet been tested by a House or presidential election. Paul Ryan's idea is that if you have to get the issue out there in order to detoxify the issue. I think that's what this election will start to be about now. Whether he's able to detoxify the Medicare issue, remove it as a third rail that you can't even talk about, bring the discussion to whether people will start to see it as something that has a cost and in terms of the deficit. The election will be fought on that basis. When Henry Gassaway Davis was chosen by the Democrats in 1904, they didn't have to worry about a TV debate. The TV debate is not a hugely important thing, but in some elections, 1976, when Dole was perceived as being too angry, and the election was so close that anything that could cost like a half point in the polls was going to turn that thing, Dole's performance may have hurt. You hear some theorizing that John Edwards talking about Cheney's daughter in the 2004 vice presidential debate and the immediate reaction set up to it and the kind of the phone calls and the talk radio and things like that might have hurt 2004. It's no reason to pick a nominee of how they're going to do in this debate. It's just one event in an election because many people don't even watch that debate. But it is one new ritual that since 1984 has been a consistent part of American politics now. Ryan helps. He's the budget chairman, so he's going to be able to perform in terms of the numbers at the debate. He's an articulate person. So there were no such TV debates when Davis was running for vice president in 1904, but you did have to stump around. And somebody like Ryan is a good asset there, I believe. The pick surprised me, to be quite honest. I would have thought we were talking about somebody from Virginia, Florida, or Ohio. Now, I'm an observer of history, and I think that gives you a little more respect for the Electoral College than some political campaigners have. Political campaigners, I believe, are a bit biased towards the media, so they're going to be looking for buzz, they're going to be looking for who's going to get the troops excited and things like that. I look at so many elections, especially the recent ones, and you know, turn one state here with a VP choice, and that's a good enough reason to pick someone. So I was surprised not to see a governor from one of those states, but then again, it's possible that governors did not accept a young and House member who was eager to take the battle to the president. Other than that, we'll keep watching. You know, I'm surprised by the pick. I'm not going to say good or bad at this point. I had said, you know, the one thing a challenger has to do, unify that party. It's the only thing you can unify. It's the only army you have. Well, it's accomplished that goal. So that's definitely one on the checklist. Now we're going to see the things to keep watching. Is there agreement on issues between the two candidates? Can they keep the unity up? Is the Ryan plan spun as kind of a, this is what we need to do in a nonpartisan way to save the country? Or does Ryan become more of the traditional bulldog role of the vice president, which Joe Biden on the other side is certainly going to play. And if you're talking about it as I suspect it is, rather than picking, say, Bob Portman to be try to get a chance to win Ohio, you're picking a guy who's going to motivate the troops in all those states and hope to boost turnout, beat Democrats in the turnout game. That's something you're not going to see until Election Day. Other than that, not much more to say, and we keep watching events. I got a bunch of new casts lined up. I do want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. Facebook site to discuss issues, and the archives available for $14.99. Helps the book fund. If you like the program, it's so important. Tell someone about it. Post on your blog. It's the kind of program that's a little bit obscure, and people will discover it only by other people who like it. Thanks for listening.